Welcome to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. Autonomous test cars are headed to Ohio after Governor Kasich signed an executive order allowing companies to test cars on public roads. No driver required. Columbus-based IT company Pillar Technology will spend a $2 million research and development grant from Jobs Ohio to develop driverless vehicles here. Joining us now is the CEO of Pillar Technology, Bob Myers. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Tell us about the Jobs Ohio grant. What are you going to spend it on?
We are going to spend it on helping autonomous vehicle development, specifically the software development, be done in a way that is proven to get better and better over time.
So what's the competition out there for testing grounds for autonomous cars? Is this good for Ohio to have this executive order in place now?
Absolutely. I mean, this is a race to the future for most of the automakers. Clearly, this is going to happen at some point. It's already happening in the industrial world. There's a tremendous amount of autonomous automation as far as moving products and warehouses and things like that that'll extend out into the rest
forklifts,
of the world.
All that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
Moving things around. What have we learned from the autonomous devices being used in the in industry about putting cars on the road with ordinary people?
Well, we've learned some. It's very easy to do autonomous in a constrained environment. That's a path that you run frequently.
And everybody there knows where it is.
Exactly.
Yeah.
That's a whole different ballgame when you're out in the wild, wild west where anything can happen. But we'll learn fast. There's autonomous research happening all over the world with all the major automakers. And we're advancing this much faster than probably people realize.
How much was a setback, the episode in Phoenix where an autonomous vehicle killed a pedestrian?
I mean, that's a tragedy, of course. Anytime you lose life, it's a tragedy. But just in Ohio, there are 3 deaths a day as a result of human error. So you do that math, that's about 50,000 people a year. You multiply that times 50 states, that's, what, 2.5 million?
Well, all things being equal, Ohio is very populous,
yeah.
But yeah.
I mean, there's a lot of people dying from auto. If the autonomous vehicle software is built correctly, meaning it's machine learning or artificial intelligence, and it's tested properly, and it's written so that it can adapt quickly, and we get our smart city connectivity there, the situation that occurred in Phoenix will never happen that way ever again in that exact form. So that's the beauty of the autonomous vehicle. It will learn and get smarter and smarter, and it's not distracted. It doesn't text. It doesn't comb its hair. It doesn't, you know, talk to somebody else unless it's talking to another device for a safety reason. So over time, it will be the primary cause for eliminating most of the auto deaths that are occurring on a day-to-day basis.
You're listening to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. The governor has signed an executive order allowing testing autonomous cars on Ohio's roadways. My guest is Bob Myers. He's CEO of Pillar Technology, a company that wants to and is working in that ilk and is planning on working in it more as Ohio evolves and as a city like Columbus builds up its smart city infrastructure. Columbus is going to be one of those smart cities, right?
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
What is that? What does a smart city have to do with autonomous vehicles?
So a smart city basically talks to all of the devices in the city. So traffic lights, there will be sensors all throughout the city that will measure traffic flow, human pattern flow. It will help you to reroute traffic in high traffic situations. It'll be connected to public safety. It'll be connected to emergency vehicles. It'll be connected to first response kinds of situations. It'll be connected to commerce. You can basically rely on a smart city to tell you where to go if you're a visitor, where to find various things, where are the popular things that you personally like versus looking at a listing that's kind of generic for anybody that comes into the city. So it'll be exciting. There was a smart city contract that was awarded to Columbus. It was one of 70 cities that won it. And fortunately, we were also a part of that. And we're going to be building that smart city operating system in connection with some of the autonomous research that we're doing. So it'll be a really exciting place here in the next 6 to 8 to 12 months.
Will it look different?
I don't know if it'll look different on the surface, but you'll definitely see cars running around that will be autonomous vehicles.
Will you be able to notice that?
Oh, yeah.
Won't there be anybody in the car?
There will be. There's always, in his legislation, somebody has to be either in the car or monitoring the car through a computer system.
And I wanted to ask you, what does that mean to monitor a car through a computer system? How does that work? Is that like drone technology,
no,
that kind of a thing?
You'll be connected to the car through some kind of console, and you will actually have full control of the car.
So you'll see what the car can see.
You'll see where the car's going. You'll see any warnings as far as traffic. So it's kind of like a air traffic control system, but for vehicles.
If the governor hadn't signed this executive order, would there have been obstacles that people don't realize otherwise?
Yeah, it would have been illegal.
So it already was illegal. So his executive order overrides other laws that have been put in place?
There wasn't a law, but there wasn't a specific order that said you could do it.
Okay.
So it was gray.
What about local other municipalities in the central Ohio area? Could they enact local ordinances against this?
You know, I'm not sure about that. I would encourage them not to, because this is going to be something that you want your city to be involved with. There will be jobs created as a result of
how many
technology.
Because I mean, Jobs Ohio is involved in this, so the assumption is there'll be jobs created, although they're very opaque and we're never sure exactly what's coming out of that agency. But how many jobs in this case?
Hundreds. There's no question in my mind that there will be hundreds of jobs created as a result of this technology being available here in the state. I can just tell you hundreds of jobs have been created in my company mm-hmm. as a result of.
What kind of jobs?
There are IT jobs right now, technology, software development.
Mm-hmm.
But there will be jobs created to install smart devices throughout the infrastructure in Ohio. There will be jobs created to maintain the roads at acceptable levels so that autonomous vehicles can see divider lines, because those will be much more critical
mm-hmm.
in the future.
The lines in the center lines
yeah.
in the streets, okay?
Yeah.
What kind of workforce do you need to do this?
Well, you need a workforce that's going to adapt, because the problems that we're solving today in our infrastructure are going to be different problems in the future. They're going to be sensor problems. They're going to be network fiber problems. They're going to be kind of high-tech problems to solve. Not necessarily maintaining the roads. We'll still have to do that. But they'll be way more sophisticated and much more high-tech. So there'll be an electronics component to almost everything we do in our infrastructure.
The kind of cars we're going to see popping up in the next year, year and a half, what are they going to look like? Is there going to be a manufacturer that's more apparent?
I don't think so. You'll see
all different makes?
You'll see every make and model in an autonomous vehicle fairly quickly. You know, obviously, there are some leaders in the space right now. You know, Google's been doing autonomous vehicles mm-hmm. for quite some time. Uber's really investing a lot in autonomous cars and autonomous and self-flying taxis. I don't know if you've seen that.
Finally, we've got what they promised on the 21st century.
Yeah. we have some insight into most of the automakers, most of the automakers that you're going to see on the roads today have an autonomous vehicle initiative. So we're hoping to bring all those to Columbus.
There are going to be haves and have-nots, though, with any kind of huge breakthrough technology like this is suggesting. Not everybody is going to be able to afford an autonomous vehicle. I mean, most, you know, it's already crazy expensive to buy, you know, a car these days, a new car.
Yeah. Used to be. Have you seen the Model 3 from Tesla?
I've heard about it. You're right. Yeah. And so you're saying they're getting less expensive. They'll come down.
Yeah, they'll come down. It's just like your phone. You know, when you bought a phone 10 years ago, it was incredibly expensive. You buy a phone today and you don't even pay for it.
You mentioned the Model 3 from Tesla, but Tesla's not doing so well financially.
Yeah, they'll come out of it.
You think the big automakers have the economies of scale to support this change in technology? And Tesla?
Tesla's got the technology. The big autos have the manufacturing horsepower.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sure there'll be a merger of those two in some form.
Hmm. You've called this the space race of our generation. Who are we racing against?
Really ourselves. You know, it's our automakers and our tech companies that are in the race. So tech companies obviously need to understand the manufacturing component of it. The manufacturing side of it needs to become a tech company. So that's really the race, is who can get these things into the marketplace, tested, working, and viable more quickly.
We've been thinking in terms of, I've been thinking in terms of personal vehicles. What about mass transit? How could this change that dynamic?
Radically.
Mm.
Radically. You know, that is one of the social issues that we're having conversations inside our company with. Trucking, for example.
Hmm.
You know, what are we going to do with truckers if trucks become automated? You know, that's a real challenge. You know, how do we transfer displaced jobs into new jobs?
So you're thinking about that?
Oh, absolutely. It's a big deal. Really big deal. I had a long conversation with probably five of our engineers the other day. I said, what are some of the things that these people could be doing right now to prepare for autonomous?
And what were some of the ideas?
Installing the sensors, transferring over to infrastructure. Obviously, they have tremendous knowledge of roads.
Logistics.
Roads conditions, mm-hmm. logistics. When you get rerouted or you go through a detour, there's a autonomous way to be detoured, and then there's a more practical way to be sent around a detour. So, you know, those are some of the things that we talked about, but I'm sure there's more.
And, you know, when you talk to some, is that a moral issue for you, or is it a pragmatic issue as
both.
A developer of, you know, or autonomous vehicle technology?
It's both. We got to take care of our people, you know, in the U.S., provide job opportunities for them. And, you know, I don't want people displaced with nothing to sustain their family. So we whenever we introduce a technology, we have to think about what are the ramifications of that technology. So those are the kinds of conversations that we're having in addition to advancing the technology.
Bob Myers, thanks so much for joining us today. I appreciate your time.
Yeah, it was great talking to you. Thank you for inviting me.
Bob Myers is CEO of Pillar Technology. Pillar Technology will spend a $2 million research and development grant from Jobs Ohio to develop driverless vehicles here. We're talking about that because Governor Kasich signed an executive order allowing companies to test cars on public roads in Ohio. No driver required. We'll probably have a lot more on that as time goes by. We'll be right back with Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Tech Tuesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. It's time to dust off those pre-digital cameras. The meteoric rise of digital and smartphones left film photography on the brink of extinction. But it's kind of cool again. More and more photo buffs are ditching the convenience of digital for the hands-on experience of film. Photographer Matt Marsh teaches classes on film photography and developing at Midwest Photo. He also co-hosts the film photography podcast to advocate for film, and he joins us now. Welcome to the show, Matt.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Also joining us is the president of Midwest Photo, Moishe Applebaum. Welcome to the show.
Thanks for having us.
Moishe, a quick timeline on the emergence of digital and when it appeared to take over from where you sit at Midwest, which is a long time Central Ohio staple.
So definitely early 2000s, we started to get into it pretty heavy, for sure. It just started to take over. And at a certain point, the actual resolution started to surpass what was available and what you could do really with 35 millimeter film, for sure.
Did you measure that in terms of what cameras you were stocking and selling, or what kind of film you were selling and whether you were selling film?
So, yeah, it was really a combination of both. You know, the demand was there and people started to see the emergence and the value in doing digital photography, and just slowly started to take over the landscape.
How did that feel?
Wow, it was, you know, a really, really interesting time. I mean, every day it just seems like there's new stuff that's emerging and that's exciting in this space. And it's just been, I am honored that I get to be living during this time in photography.
Big and transition.
Seeing, yeah.
I remember getting a survey. Someone called my house and did a survey, and it ended up being like a half hour survey about digital, and it was
really
probably in the early 2000s, because I remember where I was living at the time. I knew, you know, I can remember it, and they just went on and on and on, and I was still using film, and I thought, well, this is absurd. I mean, it's not like it's going to take over, but it kind of did.
And quickly.
Yeah. Matt, is it Marsh? I'm sorry.
Oh, Marsh. It's
Marsh.
Fine. Yeah.
What saved it from the brink? When did you start to see people interested in film?
Well,
as a hobby, I guess, really.
It's definitely shifted from commercial and professional use to fine art and kind of just this niche hobby. I'm actually a digital native. I learned entirely using a digital camera and then made the step back. Early on in digital cameras, manufacturers were using a lot of the same sensor technology, and it was really hard to make photography your own with digital. And picking up film was just another way to kind of stand out at first, and now it's just kind of blossomed back into this this beautiful thing. We're using these old tools. Most of the time, they're older than the average user of the camera. The camera I have here with me is 5 years older than I am. So I got the SLR 680. You might remember this.
Oh, it's a Polaroid.
Yeah, the most radio-friendly sound ever. Let's see if we can get it going
here.
Yeah.
Oh, no, take a picture of it.
Yeah, we'll take a picture of it.
Oh, my gosh. No, it's an old Polaroid. Yeah.
All right.
Now, I used to know someone who did art with Polaroids. Oh, that's a familiar sound.
Everybody knows that sound.
You start to see them at wedding receptions and that kind of a thing. People just do that and make those kind of Polaroid books.
Mm-hmm. So much fun.
Yeah.
It's just so much fun.
Well, is it Polaroids or is it film, traditional 35 millimeter or what? Or
it's
all of the above?
It's kind of all lumped into the analog category now, just like we're seeing records on the rise again, even
vinyl.
Cassette tapes.
Yeah.
Yeah. Film is kind of back in that little niche. So it's definitely not the same amount of shooters, but the users now are very, very dedicated folks.
And are they digital natives like you?
A lot of them are digital natives. It's funny, when a lot of younger kids see a Polaroid, they're like, oh, it's like Instagram. Or is Instagram like Polaroid?
Yeah.
So
yeah.
It's just a very interesting shift, and it's fun to see. It's hard to gauge, you know, the popularity of a lot of digital. The audience always tends to be older for a lot of camera shops, but now all these younger folks are coming in asking about film. They have their dads, their grandfathers, their great-grandfathers'
camera.
And they're
happy, too.
And they're getting film for it.
You probably went through the phase where you had a lot of digital classes.
Absolutely.
Teaching people how to use your, I remember going to one of those. Yeah.
Yeah. So we have, we do a tremendous amount of classes, probably close to 200 every year, about 200 a year. There have definitely been a resurgence of the analog classes as well with Matt teaching darkroom. I know when we built our new location a couple years ago, we surveyed our customers to say, what do you want in our new location? And of course, the parking was a big issue. And, you know, there were all sorts of things.
You used to be on High Street in a tough parking spot.
Yeah. Number six on the list was actually a darkroom. So we built a darkroom at our new location. And, you know, now every single month when we offer that darkroom class, Matt's selling it out.
Really? You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. It's Tech Tuesday, and we're kind of taking a step back in time because with every advance in technology, there's always the nostalgic yearning for what was before, and that's no less the case with photography. My guest, Matt Marash, he's a local photographer. He's also a sales associate at Midwest Photo here in Columbus, and he teaches classes for people who are new to analog, who are new to film and Polaroid type film. He is co-host of the Film Photography Podcast. That's an internet radio show and an advocacy group for him. And also with us, Moshe Applebaum, president of Midwest Photo. Love to hear from listeners right now who are making that foray into the past with Polaroid technology, film technology, 35 millimeter. Give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. You know, I have an old 35 millimeter camera that I'd love to use again, but some film was left in it and it went kind of bad. Is it worth it to bring a camera back in and get it fixed?
Absolutely. Most of the time, you'll be surprised. It probably just needs a battery. Very seldom are the cameras unworkable. And sometimes if the film is, as long as the film isn't from like the 40s, you can get pictures off of it. It's crazy how old the film can be. In fact, some people chase that look of strictly expired or worse film. One of the most interesting things about film photography is it's imperfect. A digital picture is perfect. There's no dust on it. There's the colors are wherever you want them to be. Film, yeah, you're getting what you're given when you
even
press the button.
Subject, you can't do that.
That's
can't do anything about the subject.
It imparts its own little look onto it, and it's at the end of the day, you're the only person to blame for it. So that's what's great about analog.
Dark rooms are kind of a rarity nowadays, right? I mean, I know when I worked at the Columbus Dispatch, there was a big dark room. That's no more. They just don't need it anymore. So do people want to use the dark room?
Yes. We've had people travel actually halfway across the country just to use our darkroom space because it is one of the most affordable in the country. You can rent it out by the hour, by the half day, by the full day. You can even bring in your own gear and kind of move in. We have all the chemicals to do black and white film processing and printing. So we have a big enlarger in there and people are making silver prints for shows.
Artists.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I would say a lot of artists, a lot of hobbyists as well, for sure.
Are you selling more old film cameras now?
Absolutely. Yeah, we're selling a lot of old film cameras.
Do they even make them anymore?
There is one or two manufacturers out there that are still making the 35 millimeter cameras that you can find. A lot of the legacy stuff, though, is just so good that, you know, it really, where you can buy an old Nikon or an old Canon or Pentax camera that, you can still get all the lenses for and, you know, spend $100 on a camera and have this plethora of lenses that, you know, just, it's pretty amazing.
Yeah. Do you see it once people start it, they're hooked?
Oh, yeah. They are definitely film junkies. They need to come in and get their fix. The rolls of film, it starts off every time they leave with a film camera. We usually give them the first roll of film for free because we know they're going to be back. Try different emulsions. That's another thing. You have to try different looks.
Just like people, but it's so easy with digital because you could just do a filter. You don't have that that absolute, you have to experiment.
It's definitely an experimentation thing. A lot of folks learn a little bit more about what they want out of their photography by using a film camera.
Uh-huh.
So there's a trust factor involved, but it's fun. Yeah.
What about film development? Who's even doing that anymore?
So the last big game in town for film development would be McAllister Photo Works.
That's right, over on Sawmill.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. There, we always send folks over there. There's also a local gentleman, Mr. Mark Fole. He does black and white services. I also believe he does those for McAllister's. And he's a great customer of ours here, so sends people into the darkroom.
But you can't go to your CVS anymore.
A lot of places you can't go there, and some places will mail it out. And crazy enough, when you mail it out through a lot of those services, they won't even give you your negatives back. So we recommend still going with a small trusted lab.
Why won't they give you your negatives back?
A lot of these mail order services, they just give you a disc back. It's kind of crazy. Yeah, they just keep everything else.
Oh, okay. Let's see. Terry in Youngstown, you're on the air. Hi, Terry.
Hi, Ann. When I took photography, I always enjoyed putting two negatives together to make one print. And with the digital cameras, you can't do that. I'm just wondering if in the near future you can put pictures together and make one print, you know, through the digital process.
Well, certainly you can do it with software, for sure. Now, you could import or open both photos in Photoshop and then layer one over the other and create a multiple exposure that way.
But it won't be quite the same thing, Matt. You're giving me that look.
It's definitely not the same. Almost everything that we can do in Photoshop is derived from something that you can do in the darkroom. Once you learn what went into it, the painstaking process that went into it, and now it's just this Photoshop filter, it definitely doesn't have that same feel. You might not like what you make in the darkroom, but it's genuine. It's yours. It's what the fruit of your efforts. Yeah.
Yeah. Terry, thanks a lot for that call. 614-292-8513. Or you could email us at allsides@wosu.org if you have a question about photography right now. We're talking about going back in time and using analog photography, using film photography, and learning how to use a darkroom as well. I never did. Is it hard?
Oh, no, it's super easy. You press the button and we'll take care of the rest.
Magical. It is so magical.
It never gets old watching that print just come up in the tray.
I remember when I worked at newspapers, I would go in the dark room and hang out with photographers and stuff like that and watch things come to life.
And when it's yours,
was. Yeah.
It's just magical.
Yeah. Is the interest mostly in black and white? Because that is unless you use one of the filters, that's kind of missing in digital photography.
It definitely isn't the same. Black and white that's my preferred working medium.
Yeah.
Mainly, I'd be broke if I shot color. It's a little more expensive.
Yeah.
But black and white is definitely something special. It's always been a little more abstract from the rest of the world that most of us see. And it's easy to get proficient at printing there, but there's so, like, to get to that master level, it's just years and years of continuous work with it. And so many different creative things you can have come out of it. One of the biggest things I hear from folks after taking a darkroom class or looking at other black and white work, I don't know why, but this looks like a painting. It doesn't look like a photograph. So mm-hmm. There's more of that hands-on feel. And I think it's the same. Digital was supposed to kill film. Film photography was supposed to kill painting. So there's always kind of that regression back.
Is film more expensive nowadays? Because there's less of a demand for it?
It's a little more niche. It's definitely not. It's a couple bucks more per roll than it used to. But black and white, you can still get for less than $5 a roll. Color for less than $10 a roll. So it really hasn't changed too much. A lot of the manufacturers are kind of subsidizing that and getting people back into film. The processing is probably where it'll get a lot of folks. So learning how to do your own black and white processing, like we teach at Midwest Photo, is incredibly cost effective. If I were to pay somebody to do it, it's almost $10 a roll. And if I do it myself, it's 5 cents.
Is it hard to set up your own darkroom?
It's very easy. I could do it in my bathroom at home, but it's much nicer to have a place I can lock up at night.
Yeah. Yeah. Only have to clean up every time you get
exactly.
done, right?
Feels like doing the dishes.
Right. Elena and Hilliard, you're on the air. Hi, Elena.
Hi, Ann. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I was just calling in today because I was really interested in the conversation you guys were having. My first camera was a Polaroid when I was a child.
Yes.
And I am, yeah. And I was really, really inspired by the moments that I was able to capture. And they didn't always look the best. And, you know, I was young, so I took pictures of leaves and bugs in my house and things like that. But they always held very special moments for me. And I maintained my interest in photography, particularly digital photography, when I got into my adulthood, but I still kind of miss that essence of being able to actually capture a moment and have that moment be what it is when it came out of the camera. Whereas, you know, with digital photography, you can alter it and change it and filter it, but it's not, you know, it's not really that moment. So I just kind of wanted to bring that to the conversation.
Yeah, I just want to run home and get my Polaroid out and get my get my 35 millimeter out now and drag the 35 millimeter somewhere, because I know there's something amiss with it. But it does make you want to just get back into it, doesn't it, Elena?
It does. Yeah, very much so.
Go get a Polaroid.
I will.
Be young again.
Thanks, Dan.
All right. Take care. Amy Jurevich, who's running the board for me, she says, my grandma gave me my first camera and it had flash cubes that you attach.
Oh,
remember
yes.
those?
No, I miss that.
I remember those. Definitely. It was more fun to watch them sizzle than to see what the picture was going to be. So what are you expecting? I mean, are you expecting this just to grow, Moisha?
You know, that's a good question. I think that it will. I mean, you know, my 17-year-old daughter Zoe, for her 16th birthday, asked for a Fuji instant camera. I mean, that's really what she
you
wanted.
Mean the throwaway kind of camera, or
no, like the Fuji makes a similar camera to what Polaroid does.
Oh, okay.
So it's very similar. But you know, I see them all the time. Everywhere I go, I see, you know, these instant cameras. I'm seeing more and more people shooting with film. So, you know, I think it's here to stay for a while, for sure.
It's found its place.
Yeah,
it's found its little niche. You're always going to have artists that are consciously choosing something that, even if it is quote unquote a lesser technology, it's distinguishing to them. It's their hands-on bit.
Well, Matt Mirosh, thanks for joining us today to talk about it. I appreciate your time.
Oh, thank you so much. This has been great.
Matt Mirosh is a local photographer. He also is a sales associate at Midwest Photo in Columbus. He teaches classes for people who want to learn about film and also darkroom techniques. He is co-host of the Film Photography Podcast. That's an internet radio show and advocacy group for film. And also Moisha Applebaum, he's president of Midwest Photo. Thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having us, Ann.
We'll have more Tech Tuesday coming up on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Tech Tuesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Dan Fisher. President Trump wants to bring back ZTE, the Chinese smartphone giant that Trump's Commerce Department banned from purchasing U.S. hardware and software. This week, the president tweeted that he's working with President Xi of China to revive ZTE. Joining us now to talk about that and other tech news is contributing editor at Android Central, Russell Holly. Welcome as always, Russell.
Thank you.
First, we know by now ZTE is this very big corporation in China, because we know that it employs a ridiculous number of people. First of all, what do they make and why were they banned from purchasing U.S. software and hardware?
ZTE makes a whole bunch of different things that are all, you know, related somehow to the mobile space. You know, they make mobile networking equipment, but the big thing that they're known for is smartphones and tablets. They're actually the fourth largest manufacturer of smartphones in the world. We don't know them a whole lot here in the United States, typically because they are one of the brands that are sold as kind of budget phones in a lot of places like Boost Mobile or on T-Mobile shelves as kind of the buy one, get one free phone. So they're, as a brand name, ZTE isn't particularly well known here in the U.S., but they sell all around the world, and they've been gaining steam here in the U.S., with an attempt last year to make kind of a higher-end phone that can compete with the iPhone and some of the higher-end Android phones with a model called the Axon 8. But they were also caught selling as part of their global strategy to Iran. And that was as part of the embargo, you know, providing, you know, any kind of you know, financial help or hardware help, technological help to that country and to other countries was illegal if you wanted to continue doing business with the United States. And ZTE is one of several companies who has recently caught violating that. And so the Justice Department said that they were no longer, not only were they not allowed to sell their phones here in the United States, but they were actually not allowed to buy software from companies in the United States. And since the primary operating system on all of ZTE's phones is Android, and Android is owned and maintained by Google, they couldn't operate with Google to make these phones, which is the bulk of their business.
All right. So on one hand, you have the Trump administration's Commerce Department banning them from these purchases, from using these components. On the other hand, now we have the president tweeting that he wants to bring it back. Isn't that unusual?
It's more than a little unusual, and it's not clear what the immediate benefit to the United States is for this particular action. ZTE is not a huge force in the United States. There isn't an immediate, boost to American jobs one way or the other if ZTE is continuing to function or not. This definitely, from the message that was sent, it sounds an awful lot like this is something that the president of China asked as a favor, and without a whole lot of explanation as to why we have a change that's being put in place. We don't know exactly what that change is going to look like yet either.
I was going to say, are they withdrawing the ban then, or what?
Yeah, we don't really have any clear indication of how exactly this is going to work, especially since this was a court ruling, not just a kind of a wave of the hand from the Justice Department. This was, based on trials against upwards of 32 employees for ZTE to go against the deal that was put in place to say that you couldn't sell these products in these countries.
So we just don't know what the challenges are going to bring. I mean, should Americans be worried about bringing ZTE back? Is this something that affects us?
The only way that this affects us is it means that the consequences that we levied against the company for doing something that we said is a very bad thing. Is not an enforceable thing, across the line. It says that companies who behave in a way that we feel is untoward, as long as you get approval from our president, it's okay to behave that way.
Could it be an opportunity though, if they have had, if they're having their troubles, isn't that an opportunity for U.S. manufacturers and manufacturers with a good reputation with the United States?
It's an opportunity in some places. It would not be an opportunity in some of the places. It would not be an opportunity in the places where ZTE is most popular. China, for example, the phone manufacturers that are continuing to make headway there are companies that are starting to manufacture directly there, and so it's less likely for that to be an immediate benefit to any U.S. based company. But we have seen a lot of other manufacturers, like Xiaomi and Huawei, for example, have both made tremendous progress in India and China as well, and those are very rapidly growing markets. So those are companies that also do a lot of business in the United States that could have easily benefited from this.
Let's turn to Star Trek. Star Trek Bridge Crew is getting next generation downloadable contact on May 22nd. Tell us what we're talking about here. What's downloadable contact, and tell us about the game.
Sure. So Star Trek Bridge Crew is one of the first virtual reality games that unified all of the headsets to play together. The idea was that you and a bunch of your friends were all different positions on the bridge of a starship, and you worked together to complete missions instead of everyone having individual ships. So it was a very cool way to kind of feel like you're a part of the Star Trek universe. And this new update that is rolling out essentially is going to give you an option to play on a different bridge with different missions, and it's going to be very familiar to a lot of kind of hardcore Star Trek fans, because all of the new things that are coming in the update are actually from the Next Generation television series with Captain Picard and Data and all of those characters. So the universe is going to feel very different for people who have been playing this game up to this point. It's just a new part of the Star Trek universe to play in.
So this is big news for people who care about that.
Exactly.
Do you care?
I do. I really enjoy this game. You know, I am a Star Trek fan, but I'm also I really enjoy the way that this game, on a technical level, links together all of these VR headsets that otherwise kind of exist in their own sandboxes and don't really play together to do other things. The PlayStation VR headset, you're usually only playing with PlayStation people, and the HTC Vive, you're usually only playing with HTC people. This was a massive effort on behalf of Ubisoft to make sure that the PlayStation people and the computer people and all of these different versions of VR headsets were able to all play the same game at the same time together.
There is a review on Ring Spotlight Cam. It's a new security camera. Tell us about what it does.
Yeah, so, you know, Ring has a couple of different camera models. Their biggest one is this doorbell camera, where you have, you know, a great big button and a camera that sits in front of it. And the idea is that when someone walks up to your doorstep, it captures a few seconds of video and feeds it off to you. And when someone presses the doorbell button, it actually pings you on your phone instead of creating a chime in your house. So that if you're in a different part of your house or you're not actually at home, you can actually respond through the speaker on the doorbell as though you were home and actually see the information that's coming through. But it's very, very obvious that there is a great big security camera, you know, right at your doorbell when you walk up and see this thing. So it's not great for subtlety. And the Ring Spotlight is a way of addressing that. This is a spotlight lamp that operates with a motion sensor, so you hang it up a little higher. And it also has a Ring camera in it that operates with motion detection and communicating with your phone. But it's up higher than the light, which means that at night it's going to be very, very difficult to see. And, you know, during the day, it's less obvious that there is a great big security camera hovering above your house.
You know, I still find it interesting that security cameras are such crap today still. I mean, we're always seeing footage from security cameras, and it seems almost totally useless. What's the problem?
A lot of it is, you know, the cameras, in order to keep, you know, costs at a specific point, in order to remain competitive, the cost of the hardware that goes inside of these, they have to be kind of particular about. Otherwise, the cameras become the most expensive part of the system. And that's actually something Ring has done really well with, to make it so that the video that comes from these cameras is, you know, noticeably higher quality. The pictures, even at night, are pretty decent. And that's something from each of the cameras that are sold for this system.
Is this like a smart house kind of a camera? Is it, can it be connected with that?
Absolutely, yeah. This is a smart house kind of a system. It's designed to, you know, wire, or not wire, but wirelessly communicate with, you know, other things in your home. You can tie these into Amazon Echo services. There's a long-term project to make it so that when someone presses the Ring doorbell, you can actually ask Google Home to play the video from that on your television and have it just kind of seamlessly work instead of having to reach for your phone for that kind of situation. So it is the aim here is to make it part of a smarter home.
And you mentioned it's usually, you know, it's expensive. So to have a good camera, how much does this cost?
These are $200 cameras with the spotlight built in, and that's kind of the base price for these because they're battery-based systems. And if you want something that doesn't need to be either recharged or hardwired, there's a solar panel that you can add to it that will you know, charge it that way. That is another expense. You're going to end up, you know, another $50 basically to power it that way.
What about setup?
Setup really depends on you. I mean, this is the kind of thing that you're mounting to your home, so you can try and do something other than, you know, screwing it into a mounting plate onto, you know, the side of your house, but that is going to be the preferred way of doing that for most people, I think.
Who do you think they're aiming for here? Just your everyday household?
Yeah, I think Ring wants to address as many people as possible, and the idea behind the Ring Spotlight is to make it less obvious that there's a great big security camera there for you know, for when someone's trying to kind of look around at your house, see if it's worth trying to break into, but also, you know, offer a slightly smarter option for areas where having a spotlight outside of your house is helpful.
You know, I'm wondering how it's going to work with smart home technology, the companies that are kind of embracing that as a whole. And then you have Ring. Is Ring involved in a deeper way with smart home technology?
The best way that Ring is involved with these companies is to offer integration with as many different services as possible. So we know that that Ring partners with Amazon and Google. They've also worked with Nest for it a little bit because Nest is kind of a competing product with its camera service, but they work with the Nest thermostat in a few ways. So there are, you know, kind of ways where Ring wants to integrate with as many things as possible because it makes it more likely that someone who is building a smart home will go with this over a competitor.
Let's turn now to the Google I/O conference. You were at that last week when we talked. One of the things they showed was Google Duplex. What is it?
Google Duplex is kind of the continuation of the Google Assistant, where its job is to kind of anticipate the things that you need and recommend things to you, tell you about your drive to and from different places and what the traffic is going to be before you're asking for it. A lot of these kind of predictive things, and part of that is language. You know, Google has been working really hard to make everything about the Google Assistant sound as natural as possible so that when you talk to it, you don't, as the person, sound robotic, you know, asking for very specific things. You can ask in a very kind of natural format, and it will understand you and respond. And as a demonstration of how well the Google Assistant has been working on not only processing natural human language, but the ability to speak with a natural human voice, Google Duplex was this kind of experiment to see if Google could act as a full assistant for someone and call an actual place and talk to an actual human mm-hmm. to do things like book a restaurant or a hairstylist appointment or something like that. And it works. There have been several instances where Google has successfully tested this software where a non-human entity, the Google Assistant as a robot, is able to call without the guidance of a human being and actually talk to another human person to make an appointment on your behalf.
I've heard it. It says, I'm calling on behalf of my client. I'd like to book a haircut, blah, blah, blah. And it sounds amazingly human. It's pretty shocking, but there has been criticism of it for that very reason.
There are a couple of things to consider here. One, it is, it's very deceptive. You know, the way that the Google Assistant called and said, I'm calling on behalf of my client, instead of identifying itself as a non-human entity, is concerning. You know, mm-hmm. there's an act of consent there that is ethically questionable that Google needs to address and says, Google has said that it intends to find a way to address that. But it's been very careful about, how exactly it intends to address this moving forward. But the other big concern there is how is Google able to guarantee this service as a form of accuracy moving forward? And also, where the line is there? What are you going to be able to ask Google Assistant to do? And when you ask it to do so, who is responsible? You know, if I pick up my friend's phone and as a joke tell the Google Assistant to call and order 15 pizzas for his house, and the pizza guy says, no, we definitely have this phone call from you. Who in that line is responsible in that situation? And it's a difficult question that doesn't currently have an answer. It's also a little jarring to the point that I have frequently heard it, referred to as creepy, that Google went so far as to build pauses and verbal tics and in one case, almost a stutter.
Yeah.
Into the way that Google Duplex calls so that it sounds very human, and this is, a continued evolution of how robocalls exist today. I've gotten several robocalls over the last year from telemarketers and such that sound human at first.
Mm-hmm.
And then you kind of realize, or at least I have kind of realized that they're not human and then hung up on them. But there are a couple minutes where it seems genuinely human, the voice on the other side of the phone. And this is an extension of that in a way that we definitely haven't seen before.
So Google said that it's going to work on this. It's going to address the concerns about the ethics of this and that kind of a thing. But what about other companies? We just have about, half a minute left.
This isn't the kind of thing that we're seeing a response to, from competing products.
Mm-hmm.
But the way that Google set up Duplex, the way that we understand it right now is there's kind of this automated system before it switches to this human voice to kind of identify whether it's talking to another robot on the other end or not.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and the way that Google made this sound, it's entirely possible that you know the phone call could happen entirely, you know, through machine language,
right?
And then not actually be a conversation between two automated systems in order to quickly make an appointment in those situations. But that's been really unclear so far.
Russell Holly, thanks as always. Great to hear from you. Thanks for your time.
Thanks for having me.
Russell Holly, contributing editor at Android Central, and on a weekly regular on Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. Thanks for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.